Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It was in a barber shop that a young Thomas Chatterton Williams first laid eyes on the main stars of the hip-hop culture in America, the blinged-out rap stars who peopled the world of black entertainment television and MTV. He started taking notes in his mind, and by the time he was in a high school senior, Thomas had embraced the lifestyle on the outside. At home, his life was filled with books and learning and a loving father, loving parents who supplied both. And inside, Thomas was conflicted. He joins us today to talk about the conflicts, the road he chose eventually, and the book he wrote about that choice, Losing My Cool. Welcome to the show, Thomas.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You bet. The hip-hop is kind of like the hip-hop culture, like a ball and chain on the psyche is sort of what I walked away from the book with. It segregated you from the larger world and corrupted you and your friends with violence and decadence and misogyny, and you have your critics of that. Who are your worst critics on this score, and how do you answer their criticisms?
Sure. Well, yeah, the ball and chain metaphor is apt. I think that For me, living in a black culture dominated by hip hop did was it told me explicitly and implicitly what things were real and authentic and what things were not real and authentic and what things were appropriate for me and what were not. And so one of the things that was always implied was that kind of academic and intellectual success were not as real as physical and material success. So the only force kind of standing against that in my life was my father and also my mother. And so I was lucky, and I ended up embracing some values and kind of being pushed towards some values that a lot of my peers did not get the chance to embrace.
You could sort of fool yourself into thinking you were going to be an economics major when you got to college so that you could go make the big bucks on Wall Street.
Right.
That's kind of how you justified it.
Oh, absolutely. And that was the one kind of thing that you could tell kids who didn't go to college that you were going to do, and they would kind of think that was real and that was cool because, you know, the end would be the same. The means were different and maybe not as real, but the end would be real. Because you could have, you know, you could have the same Benz or the same kind of flashy clothes or whatever that they all aspired to have. But in terms of critics,
yeah.
As you asked before, I just read something a few days ago on this magazine, N Plus One, a literary magazine, on their website. I read a book review that was kind of a book review about Losing My Cool, but kind of an essay and a meditation on hip-hop culture. By a white kid who was very smart and knew a lot about black history and culture. But what really upset me and what I think is a common thread with a lot of the criticism I'm taking is that we're just talking about two different things often. He's talking about music and a history of music and the innovative, seductive creativity that really is alive in hip-hop music and culture. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about ideas, and I'm talking about value systems and how that governs self-identity, and we're really not talking about the same thing. I have no interest in arguing whether Jay-Z or Tupac or somebody is a gifted artist, because I already concede the point. I grew up obsessed with the music and the culture, not because it sucked, not because it was difficult to listen to, mm-hmm. but on the contrary, I grant that the music is worthy in a lot of respects. But what I'm really talking about is the ideas that actually end up harming a lot of black kids, but also kids who are not black.
You make the point farther on in the book, more toward the end, about the different ways people use the music. For you, it kind of defined your lifestyle in your culture. But for somebody, say, for that critic in that literary piece, it's a kind of a getaway. It's not like mm-hmm. the way they live their life.
Well, exactly. And I tried to make that point as clear as I could in mm-hmm. the book that black kids fundamentally have a different relationship to hip-hop culture because somehow in the past 3.5 decades, it's come to define in many ways in the popular imagination to define blackness. And so much of my book, I'm trying to unravel my connection to a much different and deeper blackness and through my father, and then to see how he was from an environment where there were many different ways of being black. Not all of them were exemplary, but there wasn't this kind of monolithic monoculture that black culture, contemporary black culture in the hip-hop era has become.
One of the greatest, Tupac Shakur, we have a cut from that now, So Many Tears, and I wanted to talk about that after we hear it. Inside my mind, couldn't find a place to rest until I got that dug like tatted on my chest. Tell me, can you feel me? I'm not living in the past, you wanna last. Be the first to blast, remember Cato. No longer wait to see the seats, call on the sirens. Seen them murdered in the streets, now rest in peace. Is there heaven for a G? Remember me. So many homies in the cemetery shed so many tears. I suffered through the years and shed so many tears. And of course, the rest of the world eventually lost Tupac.
Yesterday was the anniversary of his, his death. Yeah, well, that's the Tupac that I love now, especially more than even when I was younger. That's the artist who feels and is sensitive, and is connecting to black history through the Stevie Wonder, the brilliant Stevie Wonder sample in the instrumental and in the beat, and that's really not the Tupac who died 14 years ago yesterday. That the Tupac who died was really this writ large, he was the same kind of thing that I'm seeing in so many of my childhood friends. He was a smart, talented, handsome kid who didn't have to be, a gangster, who ended up embracing that image as the realest expression of his essence, and it turned out in a not such a surprising way for him.
You said you wondered what he might have become had he not been murdered.
I do, because I think that Tupac actually was in the school for performing arts. He was a gifted thespian, and a lot of what we think of him now and what exists in recorded material of his work is a persona that he developed that really was just the way an actor would develop a persona for a role. He was role-playing, and a lot of people, I don't know if they really realize that or if they choose to ignore that, but you play a role day in and day out, and at what point do you become the role you're playing? Maybe he did turn himself into a legitimate thug. I saw friends and peers gradually turn from nice, middle-class kids into actual thugs. So you are your actions day in and day out at the end of the day.
You know, one of the things I've read it back to myself several times now since starting the book and finishing it. Also, it's on the back of the cover. Is the story of your name, the story about your name? Tell us about Thomas Chatterton Williams.
Sure. Well, I'm named after 18th century British poet Thomas Chatterton, who was born in poverty, and his father died when he was very young. And he was, I guess, by all accounts, he was a child prodigy, and just extremely gifted poet. And he wanted to be a poet, but his financial situation never really was getting better. He was in debt, and the poetry that he was writing at such a young age, 12 years old, 13, 14, 15, people were doubting whether he was writing or plagiarizing. And so in despair and in poverty, he ended up 17 drinking poison and taking his own life. And then some years after he died, people began to realize that the poems were probably authentic. And my father, I think, came across that story when he was a young man, and it resonated with him in so many ways. My dad was born in 1937 and grew up in the segregated South in Texas, and felt that you know, regardless of ambitions and talents, there were external circumstances that also, you know, he felt kept him from realizing his dreams. And so this boy really, you know, hit a nerve with my father. And so he thought if he has a son, his first son he would name after himself, and his second son he would name after this poet to try to pay him some belated recognition.
But he also set you a challenge.
He did, and then, you know, he always said that you wear a great writer's name, and you have to do that name honor, and that you too can be a writer, and even are a writer now. And he always told me from very early ages that I was a writer, that I was a poet or a philosopher, and I laughed because I obviously I was not, but he said, no, well, think about it. You are. Are you interested in language? Are you interested in truth? And then you are these things. You know, you already are these things. You just have to now do the work to exhibit that.
I love, I guess maybe it's because I have a 14-year-old son, but I love how you sort of set that scene where you come home from school and you go to the refrigerator and you get a bowl of ice cream and you just kind of go and then sit down, and he'd say, sit down, son.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
Just the way your dad talked to you sounded really pretty awesome.
I mean, he was very, very involved in our lives. He still is. And he was always home. So, you know, he worked from home. So in the center of the house was his office. So you had to pass through it to get to the kitchen and back to the TV. So he took those opportunities to get in your way, and I'm glad he did.
Yeah, well, he got heavily in your way. It would freak some kids out to hear about it. So we will talk about that when we return from the break, because I love freaking people out. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. You can hear news anytime you want at WOSU.org. Now featured in our local news section, Governor John Kasich creates a new healthcare office. Find out more from that story and much more online at WOSU.org in the local news section. It's 22 degrees in downtown Columbus, clouds today, a high of 27. A slight chance of snow tonight, a low of 23 degrees. There's a 50% chance of snow for Saturday and a high of 34. A slight chance of snow Saturday night and a low of 15 degrees. And looking ahead to Sunday, partly sunny skies and a high of 26. And get perspective on all the day's news with All Things Considered. Join NPR's Robert Siegel, Michelle Norris, and Melissa Block, along with 89.7's Marilyn Smith, weekdays beginning at 4 on 89.7 NPR News. And All Sides continues. Good morning from 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Thomas Chatterton Williams. He's the author of the book Losing My Cool, How a Father's Love and 15,000 Books Beat Hip-Hop Culture. Thomas, your father, as I said earlier, was pretty amazing. He was rigorously dedicated to your education. It was extremely unusual what he did. Tell us what he did, and then tell me, why didn't you rebel?
Well, what he did was that my father, he's trained as a sociologist. He has a doctorate in sociology, but as long as I was alive, he was no longer working in kind of the anti-poverty programs he had led in the 60s and 70s, but he was now running an academic preparation business out of the house, and basically he was teaching students came to study with him for the SAT test or for courses of study for science or math or what have you. And so as he was teaching these other students, he began from the second grade on teaching my brother and me as though we were students of his, but we were just students who could never leave because we lived in the business. So, in the summertime, school stopped for about a week and a half, and then and then it resumed in the house, and Monday through Thursday from 9 a.m. till 12 p.m., we studied with him, took a one-hour lunch break, and then from 1 p.m. till 3 p.m., studied some more, and then the day was ours. And then in the school year, in the evenings and on weekends, we did the same. And so I had I was obsessed with basketball, and my father bought me lots of shoes, sneakers, but I kept the shoe boxes, and over the years, I had a closet full of shoe boxes, full of vocabulary cards, flashcards, and that was that was one of the things that I just every day I memorized lists of vocabulary words. But we also did math and logical reasoning and reading comprehension. I mean, the whole thing. So by the time I got to high school and had to take the SAT test was just, a test that was comprised of all the different things my father had been teaching me to do for years. So even against my best attempts to not go anywhere with my life, I couldn't help but kind of do well enough on the SAT test that I got into some good colleges. But you asked another part. There was another part.
Why didn't you rebel?
Why didn't I rebel? It didn't strike me as a possibility. My father's not just a nerdy, bookish guy, but he's a strong, athletic, charismatic guy, and so it wasn't with a deep voice, and he's a man, and it didn't strike me as possible to defy him. I was more afraid of defying him than I was of getting into a fight outside with someone my age, you know?
I thought it was interesting, as much as he controlled your home life in that way, he really made you toe the line at home academically, but he did not interfere with your social life, even when he was scared to death that you were heading in the wrong direction.
He's a principled man, and one of his principles is that freedom is a very important thing for him. And so we did have responsibilities in the family and as children, but we also were in the process of becoming men, and so he wasn't going to, and sometimes this was really hard for him and really hard for my mother, but they weren't going to tell us who we could date or at what age we could date or these things. We did have to do our best in school. We did have to be respectful. But for instance, he just wouldn't tell me that I couldn't date the girl that I spent most of my high school years with in my first year of college with, even though she was, in his eyes, probably the worst girl possible for me.
Stacy.
Yeah.
You kept pretty much your home life. I don't know if you kept it secret, but it was sublimated when you were out and about with your friends and at school.
I didn't advertise it.
Right.
I couldn't hide all of, I couldn't hide the fact that when senior year came around, I was visiting a lot of colleges and no one else was. I couldn't hide some of the words I knew. I couldn't, sometimes I couldn't hide the fact even that I couldn't come out of the house and play basketball. But beyond that, I really didn't advertise what I was doing, how much I was studying, how important it was in my home, because those were things that put distance between myself and my peers. And when you're 16, 17, the last thing you want is to be strange or weird.
You had a cover. It was Charles.
Yeah, and then I was one thing that really worked out well for both me and my my best friend Charles was that we had a kind of mutually beneficial meeting early in high school, and we became best friends. And he was really the coolest kid in high school, and tough, and but also really smart and really popular. And so I was his best friend, and that kind of made me okay. And I wasn't, I didn't have some of the worries of being a nerd that I would have had if I was, on my own.
Mm-hmm.
But, and he, ended up in high school spending, almost every day after school at my house and a lot of weekends. studying with my father, who treated him as another son, and so he kind of got me through school, and I got him through college preparation, my father got him through college preparation, and last year he graduated from one of the top two law schools in the nation. So he did very well for himself.
He didn't have as hard a time adjusting, it sounds like. Maybe I misread that, but in the book when you write about him, he went to another university. Mm-hmm. You guys went in separate directions. You stayed, friends. But he seemed to adjust a little bit easier than you did. He seemed to straddle the two worlds a little easier.
He did. I think that actually, it's not impossible to do that, but most people can't get through the world the way he does, because mm-hmm. He's comfortable in a project hallway, and he was comfortable, in the dining room at Oxford. I think that's just a kind of a personal charisma that's too much to ask of every person in a generation, in a culture. It's not going to, that's a very special ability to kind of shape shift and code switch. So my analysis of the wider culture is that it harms kids. Charles is an example that you can get through it, clearly, but I met a lot more examples of people who couldn't shift environments with such ease than I have met people who could. And he had an easier time too, because I think he still hasn't given up on certain ideas and values that I think are problematic.
Like what?
Well, he's still very much involved in he's a corporate lawyer, and he's not really living in the life of the mind, or the search for intellectual truth in the way that I think our culture needs to emphasize more. So I think it's too tough to criticize people for being bankers and lawyers, but I think that what Black culture needs is more examples of people who are neither athletes, rappers, thugs, or bankers or lawyers, but who are poets, writers, artists, people who are trying to live with values that are not measurable in sums and quantities, I guess.
My guest is Thomas Chatterton Williams. He's the author of Losing My Cool, How a Father's Love and 15,000 Books Beat Hip-Hop Culture. If you have a question or comment for Thomas, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page or Twitter at Ann Fisher WOSU. By primetime senior year, you said that you couldn't put it into words at that time, but that you and your friends had gotten caught up in one great big demeaning dance. And a song that you say encapsulates your conflicted feelings about hip-hop by then is Let Me Ride by Dr. Dre. Let's listen.
Straight G, hop back as I pop my top, you trip. I let the hollow voice commence to pop, 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 yeah. Cause if it don't stop, I have to put my it's reverse. Go back and take another spot, cause I'm rolling in my 6'4". With all the sick and sand. Hell yeah.
Okay, Thomas, how does that encapsulate? Well, for all, in the spirit of full disclosure, there were a few words that were muffled out of there. and if we had run the entire song, it would have been half the song. But tell us, how does that encapsulate your conflicted feelings?
Well, on the one hand, I really think that's one of the best sounding hip-hop songs of all time. The beat is just melodious. It's based on a Parliament Funkadelic sample that's also in its own right a great track, Mothership Connection, and Dr. Dre has a compelling voice. He uses colorful language and slang, and it's cool. It's fun to listen to. On the other hand, what he's actually saying, the content is abysmal, and it's misanthropic, and it's also nihilistic, and it's basically in one verse he talks about how any man who opposes him, will suffer and be eliminated. In another verse, he basically gets into a discussion of some of the most virulent misogynistic themes that dominate the hip hop kind of style. And in the last verse, he delves into this deep kind of solipsism that doesn't really ever get outside of one's own narcissism, right, and one's own thoughts, which I think is actually maybe the most dangerous thing about hip-hop culture, is that it really emphasizes an obsession and a kind of, it creates a prison of the self. You never get outside of your own thoughts, desires, wants, feelings of disrespect, feelings of triumph, and ever relate to others or engage with the wider world. And so I think the content is both seductive and ultimately negative. So I am conflicted because
you like to listen to it.
I like to listen to it, but once I got old enough to kind of question things, it's difficult to listen to it earnestly, which is what we used to all do.
When you were listening to it as a youngster, as a young guy, did you really listen to the words?
I did, yeah, absolutely. I did. A lot of people, I guess, listen, don't. Well, I don't know how other people listen to. I think that we all listen to the words, actually, because we could all recite them.
Okay.
And we're not fools. You know, if you recite a very uplifting poem over and over and over again, even without thinking, your spirit feels uplifted. I think if you recite very negative stuff over and over and over again, even without pausing to think, it's working in your brain, it's creating a feeling, it's bringing you down. So my father, for instance, my whole life made my brother and me memorize certain poems. One was Invictus. And this is a very uplifting poem, no matter what circumstance does to me. My head may be bloodied and bowed, but I'm not. My soul, my spirit will not be defeated. These things, I think, really stand in contrast to the kind of poetry that came out of the song you just played by Dr. Dre.
Tell us what you wrote that, you and your friends had all gotten caught up in one great big demeaning dance.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that dance. What was going on by then?
Well, you're talking about after my high school prom.
Right.
Bunch of us went down to the Jersey Shore, but it was not really, well, in the little corner of the Jersey Shore we were inhabiting that weekend, it wasn't an Italian-American environment. It was just us. We rented out a lot of hotel rooms, and we had a one long after party, and we basically, in every way available to us, tried to recreate, without probably thinking it through, we were recreating, exactly what we saw in music videos and stuff like that. So there was Hennessy, there was people were smoking marijuana, and there was a lot of really kind of meaningless, casual, promiscuous sex, where ultimately the women, I think, came out really, really bad in that. And I think we all left. Well, I don't know what everybody left thinking, but I left kind of gloomy after that weekend, I think.
It sounded emptied out.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking earlier when you were talking, the women's studies people could have a field day.
Yes.
With hip-hop culture.
Well, the women were some of the biggest, contrary to what a lot of people might think, the women were actually instigating and initiating a lot.
Exactly.
And living up to what they thought, I think, was what they ought to be.
If you didn't mistreat them, you weren't doing your job.
Yeah, and you could get – the craziest thing that I learned, I think, when I was about 14 was that you were going to get – even if you wanted to act differently, sometimes the harshest judges were going to be the women, the girls themselves, who were going to consider you a sucker for not ultimately disrespecting them.
Yeah, I mean, they were – the insult was clear. It was truly clear. There was also – I think this was before your senior year. This is when you and Stacey were still quite young loves. When you felt like you had to physically abuse her to
– we were 15. It was a given kind of – she did – something that I describe in the book, you know, she was, I don't know if you can really cheat on someone when you're 15, but it feels like you can when think you're in love.
Yeah.
But, you know, and the reaction that I had seen and that I had, it wasn't a reaction I'd ever seen in my home, but the reaction I had seen in the wider culture and what I understood was that you can't, like, let yourself be disrespected, and so you have to save face, and so I tried to save face, and I slapped her once, and then immediately kind of felt sickened and realized I didn't really have what it took. But I kind of pushed that thought out of my head for a few more years. But I think that was a moment of realization that I actually wasn't cut out to act that way.
Mm-hmm.
Without trying to say that I, you know, didn't do something wrong, clearly it was wrong, but it wasn't considered wrong even by her or by her girlfriends or by my friends. So there was no social ostracization. I didn't suffer a penalty. In fact, I actually think I did save some face. So, and you know, she redoubled her efforts to be with me. So socially, I wasn't penalized.
You know, you refer back to Shirley Jackson's short story, The Lottery. You read it many times. There was a collection of Shirley Jackson's work that you read often. It was an interesting choice of a metaphor for your life. And you mentioned that in the book at the time that you learned you had won a full tuition academic scholarship to Georgetown University.
Mm-hmm.
This was your chance, and you made another choice in that compared to the protagonist in The Lottery.
Yeah, well, you know, The Lottery is a story about, you know, a town that has some antiquated customs, but nobody questions them because it's just, this is who we are, this is where we're from, this is what we do. And the custom, I don't want to spoil it, but it's an old enough story.
Oh, I know. You want everyone to discover
that. The custom that they're engaging in is a ritual stoning by lottery. So whoever picks the winning number gets stoned by their family and friends and neighbors. And
it's completely and utterly accepted.
Unquestioned. And, you know, some other nearby towns are starting to wonder if they should do away with it because it's such an old tradition. It's not really, it doesn't speak to the to the modern sensibilities of the people, and the people in this town are aghast. How could you do that? That's a betrayal of our values, you know. And so I saw that in a lot of ways as, you know, as very fitting, you know, for obviously it's a metaphor, and it's fitting for the culture I was coming from, because in a lot of ways we were committed to upholding certain customs that ultimately were not as maybe as clearly deadly as a public stoning, but in some ways were slow stoning. You know, we were all stoning each other and hurting each other, and some people did actually go to jail, or one or two people died. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not without consequence, the kinds of customs that we were committed to upholding or were not committed enough to questioning and upending.
We have to take another break. When we return, we'll talk about Georgetown University. It didn't end there. We'll return with Thomas Chatterton Williams, author of Losing My Cool, How a Father's Love and 15,000 Books Beat Hip-Hop Culture. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Thank you. last week on Car Talk, once again, we were brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant.
I don't think you're.
No, I think that's. I didn't say it.
You didn't say it, and you took it back. So I'm not going to blame you for it. You had the thought. Everyone had the thought. The rest of us were smart enough not to say.
For more well-reasoned car advice, join us this week for Car Talk.
Car Talk, Saturday at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today. In 20 minutes, beginning at 11 o'clock, All Sides Weekend begins with host Marilyn Smith and a discussion of the best food and restaurants in Central Ohio. Join us for All Sides Weekend beginning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for the Statehouse News Bureau stories on 89.7 NPR News comes from the Ohio Education Association, representing 131,000 teachers, support professionals, and higher education faculty who are working for great public schools for every child, online at ohea.org.
22 degrees in downtown Columbus, clouds today and a high of 27, a slight chance of snow tonight, a low of 23 degrees. There's a 50% chance of snow for Saturday, a high of 34, and a slight chance of snow Saturday night and a cold night, a low of 15 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Thomas Chatterton Williams. He's author of Losing My Cool. If you'd like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Thomas, just because you made it into college and even into a great college didn't mean that you'd slipped the yoke of hip-hop. You used that phrase, slipped the yoke, as the title of Chapter 5, and you know, the uniform remained a big part of your life. You segregated yourself from your white classmates and roommates. Tell us about that.
Well, I did. And, you know, I don't know what, it's been 7 years since I graduated college, but I imagine it's still like this in many ways. Especially at good schools, I think there's a kind of a there can be a culture of opposition within, like, of the black or maybe sometimes Latino communities, where you really define yourself adamantly against the mainstream or dominant culture. And so you really emphasize where you're from and that you're real, sometimes even harder than you would if you were in an all-black environment. And so I found myself going to lengths to avoid, you know, anything that wasn't black, especially my first semester at Georgetown. And, you know, and so I delved into this black community that was really dominated at a school like Georgetown by athletes and also by kind of by types of students who got status for reasons other than intellect. Mm-hmm. So you could get status from being, obviously, everybody can get status from, anybody can be popular by being good looking. But also the athletes were really who ran the culture. And then, you know, this kind of student who came from, you know, a very real background and was there on scholarship or something could be very cool. But the kids I noticed who were the least popular and cool in this black community were just the straight up students, the kids who were really there to learn and there to get an education. And so I really committed myself to trying to avoid the fate of just being a nobody and wanted to stand out. So I tried to be cool. I bought so many clothes and I spent a lot of time hanging out and not doing what I was ultimately sent to college to do, which was to get an education.
Yeah, you were on academic probation?
I was after my first year. I came home with some shame that summer on academic probation. I hadn't attended a lot of classes. I thought I wanted to study economics, and it really depressed me.
Economics did.
And so I came home, and, you know, my father was really disappointed in me. But he was also, I guess, sensitive to the fact that I was that I had gotten through a year and that I was going back and that I was trying to do better. And I came home kind of saw my high school girlfriend as soon as I got home, and we were about as far apart as two strangers could ever be, and kind of it fizzled out with her in a dramatic way, and then she ended up revealing to me that she was pregnant by a drug dealer, and I thought, you know, that I guess I thought, you know, that's, I don't need like any of this really. What I need to do is to really make an effort, and to change, you know, a few things. And so, one of the things I did was I really threw out my whole wardrobe and bought a new one that was more along the lines of what I think an adult would dress like, and less like what an athlete or a teenager would dress like.
Mm-hmm.
And I committed myself to on my own to just reading all summer. And when I got back to school, I went to the thing that a friend of mine who was a straight A student told me to do was to go to class every day.
Oh, that's the trick.
Yeah, and I he's like, I promise you, one of the problems you're having is that you have not been going to class. So I went to class every day, and I immediately made dean's list, and then I started to get confidence in myself. You know, I came from a high school that was not really at the level of what a lot of students at good colleges come from, and so I wasn't prepared for the amount of homework and, you know, the time management skills that you have to do. These things that a lot of people encounter in college.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that once I could clear my head of a lot of the noise that was in it that was telling me to be real, to be cool, then I could focus on doing the things that allow you to be a successful student and ultimately to really get an education, which is transformative.
You met, you know, other students there that showed you that, yeah, you can still like hip-hop music, but you don't have to immerse yourself in the culture. You don't have to become
That's true.
Of that.
Yeah, I have friends with PhDs who love to listen to the music. I mean, I wouldn't want to say something so simplistic as it's a one-to-one correlation between listening to the music and not being able to be a deep, thoughtful, sensitive, nice, or functional person. Mm-hmm. It's not that simple, but you do have to at some point make the distinction between who you are and what you're consuming culturally. And so a lot of us growing up saw no delineation between ourselves and the culture. And I think the people that I know who are doctors and academics who still love the culture, what they've done is they've separated that from, at some point they have separated that from their definition of themselves.
One thing, obviously, you were introduced to other kinds of music. Let's listen to Miles Davis and then talk about the guy who introduced you to Miles Davis. That's the instrumental So What,
mm-hmm,
from Miles Davis, and very public media kind of music, I guess. The guy who you said who put you on to Miles Davis was the kind of kid you met in college. He seems built for undergraduate life, quoted from I Love It, A Movable Feast, smoked cigarettes in a certain way, knew how to drink absinthe. That was Playboy, right?
No, actually, this was a kid
that
lived across the hall from me. I think Playboy actually was not built for college life. He dropped out several times. He has since finished.
Yeah, right, Playboy. Okay, I was wondering if there was a dichotomy or that was just a first impression of him, but okay.
No. this was a kid who really was built for college life, I think. You know, and one of the, you know, for better or worse, one of the things that college life revolves around is kind of showing your musical, your really great musical knowledge and taste, and so jazz is always one of those things that I think undergrads emphasize. But mm-hmm, you know, I had never heard it before. This was a white kid.
I was kind of surprised though, because of your dad, that he didn't expose you to different kinds of music as well.
Well, the thing about my dad is he has jazz and a lot of music in the house, but mm-hmm, in our house, music was not played very often. I played it for myself in my room, but mm-hmm, my father didn't have music on just because he was, it's difficult to describe how serious he was most of the time and how even when he wasn't working, he was immersed in study and reading.
Gotcha.
And so the house was quiet as a library. Mm-hmm. But when I got to school, you know, but then, you know, I hung out with lots of kids and we listened to music all day, every day, but no one ever played Miles Davis. No one ever played something that really predated the Sugar Hill Gang.
Mm-hmm.
No one really played anything that was deep into the 80s. We basically were, you know, we grew up in the 90s, and this is the age that people say hip-hop really was at its best, and so we considered that that was black culture, period. Kids didn't listen to John Coltrane or Miles Davis. So anyway, I'm in college, and this white kid puts me on to one of the greatest, not just black achievements, but American achievements, you know, which is jazz music. And that was kind of a powerful realization to me that, you know, I used to think that something Jay-Z said was the height of black cultural achievement and artistic expression, and then you know, 1 minute of listening to So What can really blow you away and put in perspective the difference between what Miles Davis was doing and what most of what you hear now is doing.
I got to say, I still remember the first time I ever heard Miles Davis.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, the tower's coming down. It's I just remember exactly what I was doing. We have a call right now, 614-292-8513. If you want to squeeze in a call before the hour ends with Thomas Chatterton Williams. And Mark, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Welcome. And I very much appreciate Thomas's thoughtful sharing of his development of his life. And I guess maybe a little like Toto on The Wizard of Oz, he's pulled back a few curtains on some things. I guess my question for him is, he was, as you described it, Thomas, you had the ability to sort of be two personalities. You could be in the hip-hop culture, or you could maybe step back into a more academic or maybe responsible thing. And it seemed, I've seen some cases where people can do that, sort of have a split personality or Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But it seems to me with the hip-hop culture, not so much the music but the culture, there's a lot of people who may become trapped in it. And I see parallels in the white culture. There's some things parallel to that in Hispanic and Asian. And to me, there was the old movie from the 50s with Charlton Heston, The Ten Commandments, where Moses released the Israelites from outer slavery. But then when he was gone, they sort of degenerated into an inner slavery.
Exactly, yeah.
And I see parallels between what you're discussing in some things like that, or maybe Dante's Inferno or some Buddhist concepts. I wondered if the idea of inner and outer slavery and maybe parallels with other cultures, and sometimes even the white kids who white suburban kids who pretend to be urban gangsters, which is really strange, but they seem to be able to do that dichotomy. And I'll take the rest off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, the caller expressed a thought that I tried to express, but perhaps he said it better than I could. I think the outer slavery to inner slavery is really what the main thrust of, well, one of the main thrusts of the book is about. And I think that I try to discuss that when I say that, you know, my friends and I were in so many ways freer than my father's generation and previous generations were. Society wasn't constricting us and holding us back in such ways. But yet...
You mean by legal segregation.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Institutionalized, right.
We had civil rights, you know, and my father was, you know, about my age now when the civil rights movement really started making a difference in people's lives. So I can't imagine, you know, being this age and not having had civil rights, but that was a reality. But we had started to substitute a different kind of master, and we started worshiping a different master, which was no less limiting in certain ways, perhaps more so because it was invisible and it was interior. And I say in a lot of ways, you know, hip-hop culture has become the new master that we worship. And, you know, some people take a lot of offense because they think I'm talking about music, but I'm using hip-hop as a way of expressing a system of ideas and thoughts and judgments. And I think that it really does control black life and limit it. in contemporary American society.
We have an email or a message from Elizabeth on Facebook. She writes, as someone who has been told that I talk and act like I want to be white by both family and friends, when I was young, it hurt my feelings. But today at 53, I wear it like a badge of honor. That means they think I am smart.
Right. And one of the things that really, really, really bothers me is the association, whether it's explicit or implied, that white is smart and black is athletic or cool. But you know, that's something that I take strong issue with. You know, being smart. James Baldwin was smart. Ralph Ellison, W.B. Du Bois, Frederick Douglass, these were smart men. We've always had smart black men. There are many men in the community who are smart, and you can be smart and be black without mimicking whiteness. And I think that's an idea that isn't just a racist idea coming from whites, but it's also an idea that that many of us buy into. And so you have this whole thing. This is the motivation behind my hiding, my studying in high school, the idea that, you know, I'm spending time in books and studying is spending time being white. And that's one, that's the thing. The president has spoken about this. This is people take issue with this argument, but I can say from my own life experience, it's a real thing in the culture, and this is harming people as much as anything.
Just talking about this, we talked earlier about the criticism. It tends to come from, not from necessarily people like the person on Facebook, but people who didn't live the life you're living.
Well, yeah, you know, actually,
or that you live.
Sometimes I think, non-black critics,
right,
are surprised that.
Thomas, you know what? I asked the last question too late.
Okay.
Thomas has a Facebook page, though, if you want to learn more about his work. Thomas Chatterton Williams, author of Losing My Cool, How a Father's Love and 15,000 Books Beat Hip Hop Culture. Thomas, thanks for joining us today. I enjoyed it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Take care.
Bye.
That's all the time we have for All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.